From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. Yesterday, we introduced you to a woman who told campus police she had been raped by a fellow student. Her complaint then went to a campus judicial proceeding. NPR's investigative team worked with reporters at the Center for Public Integrity, and our investigation shows that campus discipline systems rarely expel men when they're found responsible for a sexual assault. To make matters worse, women haven't been able to count on help from the government oversight agency either. NPR's Joseph Shapiro has part two of our story.
Margot walked the campus at Indiana University scared. She'd startle if she saw someone who resembled the classmate she said raped her. 1 month before, she'd come back to her dorm drunk. She said a man who lived down the hall came into her room and raped her as she passed in and out of consciousness. The man would say the sex was consensual. Now Margot and that man were called together to attend a campus judicial hearing. On a college campus, this isn't a formal legal process like a court of law. It fell to two campus administrators to sort out the truth by asking the accused and the accuser for their sides of the story. The hearing quickly turned chaotic. Margot was in one room with a speakerphone. The man with his father was in a room on another floor and started calling Margot names.
It was just a shouting match, and then he's trying to call, he called me a slut. And his dad, who was not supposed to speak, starts talking and saying, these college girls have one-night stands all the time.
Documents show the accused man had left a trail of trouble. Another woman said he tried to rape her in her bed, but she'd fought him off. And the man, a freshman like Margot, had been arrested and charged with a felony for beating up a male student. The man Margot accuses did not answer NPR's request for an interview. Officials at Indiana University cited student privacy laws and also declined to be interviewed. After the hearing ended, Margot waited in the room with the speakerphone. An hour later, the hearing officer came to explain.
So the door opens, he comes in, he sits on one side of me. I remember him saying, and he used the word rape, and he said, I know that he raped you. And then he went back on what he said. He said, I believe you, I know that that happened.
The campus official told Margot the man had been found responsible for an offense called inappropriate sexual conduct while the two of them were drunk. Campus disciplinary procedures are run by educators, not by lawyers, and educators tend to think less in terms of justice and look for what they call teachable moments. Documents show the man Margot accused continued to insist the sex was consensual, but he did admit to having a drinking problem. And that was a teachable moment for the hearing officer.
He tells me that my rapist was crying and admitting that he's an alcoholic. And I remember him saying, I think we really made a breakthrough.
As a result, the punishment was light. It was already finals week of spring term. The man was suspended through the summer semester. He was told he could return in the fall if he stayed away from Margot and got counseling and alcohol treatment. NPR's investigation found that most men found responsible for campus sexual assault get only mild punishment. Reporters at the Center for Public Integrity obtained a database of about 130 colleges and universities that got federal grants because they wanted to do a better job dealing with sexual assault. Even when men at those schools were found responsible for sexual assault, only 10 to 25% got expelled. Margot expected the man she accused to be expelled.
Of course, the sentence was weak and horrible, but the fact that I had to sit there and listen to this guy tell me that he was feeling bad for the guy who just raped me. Not only raped me, but is completely unapologetic. And he breaks down and cries, and this guy is telling me how bad he feels for the guy who just raped me. I mean, it's just, that's really what broke me down the most, and it just made me feel really defeated, which I was already feeling defeated.
A few days later, a dean overrode the hearing officers and extended the suspension to last one full year. Still, Margot couldn't stand the thought that she'd be on the same campus again with the man. So, like large numbers of women who take sexual assault charges to campus judicial hearings, she dropped out of school.
This was a purely predatory crime.
That's Margot's mother, Eva. NPR has agreed to use first names to protect the family's privacy.
A man waiting in the wee hours of the night for a woman to come in who he could overpower, and that's exactly what he did. You believe the victim, and you're going to suspend him and force this victim to look for another school? It's unfathomable.
Margo's family took another route that's available to women, but rarely used. They asked the U.S. Department of Education to investigate Indiana University for the way it handled the sexual assault as a violation of Title IX. You probably know Title IX as the federal law that requires equality in men's and women's sports teams. But the law is broader than that. It says that any school that takes federal funding cannot discriminate against women. And that means putting an end to sexual harassment.
You know, our OCR complaint was really our best hope of effecting any meaningful change.
The Education Department's Office for Civil Rights, or OCR, opened an investigation. Margo argued that it created a hostile environment for her to be on the same campus as the man who'd been found responsible for assaulting her. But the department concluded that Indiana University did not need to expel the man. Between 1998 and 2008, the Office for Civil Rights ruled against just 5 universities out of 24 complaints. There were no punishments, just orders to universities to improve their disciplinary procedures. That's according to documents obtained by the Center for Public Integrity. Rosalyn Alley is Assistant Secretary of Education for Civil Rights. Presented with those numbers, she says her office will be more aggressive. She says she's prepared to use strong sanctions that have not been used in the past.
We will use all of the tools at our disposal, including referring to justice or withholding federal funds, to ensure that women are free from sexual violence.
Alley says she can't speak specifically about Margo's case.
What I can say is if a similar fact pattern presented itself now, we would work closely with university officials to make sure that that woman was protected from a hostile environment at any point during her tenure at the university, and that the behavior changed, that other women were not subject to similar acts of violence.
Still, that will come too late for Margo and her family. Margo's mother, Eva, has become a national anti-rape activist. She's gone back to Indiana to work with a new county prosecutor who has improved the treatment of rape victims. Margo's trying to get her life back on track. She's enrolled in a college in Chicago. As for the man found responsible for attacking her, he dropped out of Indiana University, too. Now he's going to school in Chicago as well. He lives not far away. Margo still startles when she sees someone on the street who resembles him. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
This is NPR.
The class is called Haitian Creole for the Haitian Recovery.
Okay, group numero 2, qui était un petit cas troublé.
Laura Wagner is preparing students for an upcoming test in Haitian Creole, the language of all Haitians, which is a mix of mostly African languages and French.
Bonjour, Madame Joseph.
Wagner is a doctoral student in anthropology at the University of North Carolina. You can still see bruises on her left arm and the limited movement of her fingers as she strolls about class. Wagner was in Haiti during the earthquake, living with a family she was observing for her research.
And I was living in a house that collapsed, and I was inside it, and I was rescued pretty heroically by some friends. Now I'm back here for a while until I figure out the best way to go back to Haiti.
A lot of Wagner's work centered on the life of a woman who lived in that house. She died when the house fell. Wagner hopes the class at Duke helps volunteers respect and not just pity the people of Haiti.
I'd like people to go in with a nuanced and human view of Haitian people as something other than objects of help and intervention.
Wagner and others teaching the class say one of the best ways to help sensitize relief workers headed to Haiti is to introduce them to the language.
So if it was just the chairs, the chaise là, but because you're qualifying with this phrase, that's why.
Reginald Patterson is a Duke doctoral student and was on an airplane leaving Haiti just hours before the earthquake. That's one reason why Romance Languages professor Deborah Jensen chose him to help teach the course. Jensen organized the Haitian recovery class after the earthquake and continues to get calls from people wanting to sit in.
They all have different plans or ideas of how this is central to their learning or to their upcoming activities in Haiti.
Relief teams of doctors and soldiers from Fort Bragg have also solicited Jensen's help before heading to Haiti.
Yeah, so I think you would say my brother first. So you would say Fremwe, Genle, Malade.
Duke freshman Amber Bivens says she's glad she enrolled in the class.
And I love how there's a diverse mixture of people in the class. Like we have freshmen, we have PhD students, graduate students, we have faculty members, we have people who aren't even in school who are taking this class. And I just love how we all have come from different backgrounds, but, you know, I guess the commonality here is that we want to help.
Florida International University has launched a similar course on weekends. Because of requests, Duke is considering offering its recovery course again in the fall. For NPR News, I'm Leonita Inge in Durham, North Carolina.
This week, NPR launched a series of stories its investigative team has been working on with reporters at the Center for Public Integrity. The investigation focuses on the troubling and persistent problem of sexual assaults on U.S. college campuses. Joseph Shapiro, NPR's lead reporter for the series, joins us now. Joe, thanks very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
What are some of the investigation's findings?
Well, first we found that colleges almost never expel men who are found responsible for sexual assault. Our colleagues at the Center for Public Integrity discovered a database of a small number of colleges and universities. These were ones that had applied for federal grants because they wanted to do a better job of fighting sexual assault. And even at these schools, these motivated schools, when a man was found responsible for a sexual assault, just 10 to 25% of them were expelled.
Is this not a police matter? I mean, that's criminal conduct.
Police often don't want to take these cases because they're not clear-cut. There's often alcohol involved. Often the assailant is someone the woman knows. It often comes down to the version of the man against the version of the woman. Also, campuses have their own police forces who will handle these cases, but they're not really equipped to do a criminal investigation.
Hmm. What kind of reaction have you been getting from colleges or Department of Education?
Well, we presented the findings of our study to Rosalyn Alley. She's the new Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights in the Department of Education. And she says she wants her department to be more aggressive. So she's ready to, she says, to take some of the toughest sanctions that are available to her, things that her predecessors haven't done. She can seek to withdraw federal funds from a university, mm-hmm. if it's not done enough to try to prevent sexual assaults. And she can also refer cases to the Department of Justice for possible prosecution.
What are some of the other things that colleges and universities can do or are doing to try and stem the problem?
Well, typically the schools teach students how to reduce their risk. So they say to women, watch how much you drink. Don't leave your Red Bull and vodka unattended so nobody can slip a date rape drug into it. But there are problems with that kind of risk reduction strategy because it puts all the responsibility on the woman. And it can end up—
It seems to be plain about it. It puts all the blame on the woman.
And exactly, and all the blame on the woman as well.
And are there other approaches that might be more promising in the environment of a
Absolutely.
Campus?
And it's called bystander education. So the idea is that you teach everyone, men and women, what they can do to prevent sexual assaults and also to teach them that they have a responsibility to do so. So it's very similar to what we do to prevent drunk driving, right? So we see a friend who's had too much to drink. You know, we know we give them a ride. We call a taxi. We hide the keys. And this is the same idea. Researchers at the University of New Hampshire I talked to have developed one of the bystander education models, and they've got research that show that it works. And they do a lot of role-playing. So they say, they teach students, what should you say when you're at a party and you hear your friends say, you know, there's that girl's really hot, I'm going to get her really drunk. And they teach the friends to speak up, and you say, hey, man, that's messed up. You know, that's not the way you get a girl. And right now, actually, at the University of New Hampshire, there's a big social marketing campaign. Every bus on campus, every bathroom stall, every campus computer, every time it turns on, it pops up a poster that has this kind of scene and dialogue on it. And the tagline says, friends watch out for one another, especially when there's alcohol involved.
Joseph Shapiro is the lead reporter for NPR's series on campus rape, and those stories are archived on our website, npr.org. Joe, thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Central Falls fired the high school staff in part to comply with the No Child Left Behind law. That law demands accountability from districts with failing schools. Former Assistant Secretary of Education Diane Ravitch was once a very big supporter of No Child Left Behind. Now she's changed her mind.
I was known as a conservative advocate of many of these policies, but I looked at the evidence and I've concluded they're wrong. I feel passionately about the improvement of public education, and I don't think any of this is going to improve public education.
Diane Ravitch is the author of a new book called The Death and Life of the Great American School System. The other day, she came by our New York bureau to tell us she thinks No Child Left Behind misuses standardized testing.
The basic strategy is measuring and punishing. And it turns out that as a result of putting so much emphasis on the test scores, there's a lot of cheating going on. There's a lot of gaming the system. Instead of raising standards, it's actually lowered standards because many states have dumbed down their test or changed the scoring of the test to say that more kids are passing than actually are. There are states that say that 80 to 90% of their children are proficient readers and proficient in math. But when the national test is given, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the same state will have not 90% proficient, but 25 or 30%. You know, Secretary Duncan often says we're lying to our kids, and we are lying to our kids. It's a kind of an institutionalized fraud that's been going on these past few years.
The threat of failure is so great because the schools can lose funding?
It's because there's punishment attached to the testing. I have no problem with testing. The problem is that when we attach or when the state or the district attaches high stakes to the test and says that teachers will get rewards or they'll lose their job or the principals will get bonuses or their school will be closed, this then corrupts the value of the measure because everybody's striving to meet the measure and they meet the measure, but usually it's fraudulent.
But aren't there some states, like Massachusetts, for example, that have imposed very high standards and have been successful with them?
Yes, Massachusetts has the best standards in the country. But Massachusetts is an exception. There are only a handful of states, with Massachusetts in the lead, that really had excellent standards. Most of the states don't.
You also trace a little bit of history here in which you seem to argue that there was a time when schools were broadening the curriculum and giving students far and far more choice about what to take and went maybe too far in one direction, and now we've gone too far in the opposite direction?
Well, I wouldn't make an argument that the schools in the past were so much better. I was very critical of the quality of public education, and I still am. But I would say that if we went back to the 1960s when criticism was very keen, the critics didn't say public education itself is fundamentally flawed and we should get rid of it. This is what's new about our current rhetoric. We now have critics saying public education in itself is fundamentally flawed and it has to be replaced by privatization of the schools. It's coming obviously from very ultra-conservative sources, and what's happened with the race to the top is that we are on the wrong track and we're accelerating the pace of being on the wrong track.
What do you mean, race to the top?
Well, the Obama administration had $100 billion in stimulus money for education, and they set aside about $5 billion of that. And they said to the states, if you want to compete for this $5 billion, you must do several things. One of the several things is that you must get rid of any limits on the number of privately managed charter schools. This is, I think, advancing privatization.
What's wrong with charter schools?
They remove students from the public sphere and turn them over to private management.
Although in some sense they're public, right? They're under the auspices of the local government, even though it might be local parents or someone who manages the school.
No, not really, because there's very little transparency with charter schools. You really don't know who's going on or what the salaries are. The basic point about charter schools is there are about 5,000 of them today, and they range across the board from very, very fine schools to absolutely horrible schools. And the only national study that's been done said that 17% of the charter schools did better than the local public school with which they were matched, and 83% were either no different or worse. So we don't have any evidence that this is going to make it any better.
You know, there's also placed into this bill, No Child Left Behind, the notion of competition between schools because, of course, schools are being compared to the test scores of other schools. And that's, of course, competition, a cherished American idea. Is there something wrong with inserting some competition into the education marketplace, if you want to call it that?
Yes, there should not be an education marketplace. There should not be competition. Schools should operate like families. The fundamental principle by which education proceeds is collaboration. Teachers are supposed to share what works. Schools are supposed to get together and talk about what succeeded for them. They're not supposed to hide their trade secrets and try to have a survival of the fittest competition with the school down the block.
Diane Ravitch is a former Education Department official in the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, and a professor of education at New York University. Her new book is called The Death and Life of the Great American School System. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
And you can find an excerpt of that book at our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.